So I feel like maybe John Blutarski found his calling as a landman in West Virginia not too many years after he was in college, based on the creative and extensive lease maintenance arguments I have encountered in my practice in West Virginia in particular. It can be, one of my clients said that their term was Appalachia HBP, was a term of art that they used in their practice in the acreage that they acquired up there. So if you haven't had that pleasure, it's an interesting place. What is it, Almost Heaven, or the banjos are still playing, or something like that? As Yogi said, this is very poorly unorganized. I hope that's not true of my paper or my presentation, but I hope you'll overlook whatever shortcomings I have and get the material across. I think it's important when you talk about savings clauses and understanding why you need savings clauses to go back to basics and what a oil and gas lease estate entails. Of course, it's a fee simple determinable with a habendum clause, and you have an automatic reversion, which is why you need a savings clause, why you may need a savings clause. And so in general, as you know, a savings clause avoids the effect of the habendum clause. It seeks to avoid the harsh result in a circumstance where the parties have negotiated or some common law concept has determined that it would be fair to maintain the lease with something other than production out of the ground. And so, you know, when confronted either at the end of a primary term or with a cessation of production or any other circumstance that would otherwise terminate the lease and revert the interest, you have to start straining through the lease, rereading it again and again, if you're like me, and trying to find something to hold on to. Let's see. Interestingly, if you litigate, generally the lessor bears the burden of proof that a lease has not been maintained, and that generally includes negating that a savings clause has maintained the lease. I think in practice, what I've seen is that it's a little less, you know, the lessor is not required to essentially set up and knock down all savings clauses that are in a lease. Instead, the issue, you know, the lessor files suit to terminate the lease, and the lessee has to articulate some kind of a, you know, reason why it's been maintained. And I think it's a little bit more of a burden shifting than it is an outright lessor having the duty to, like I said, set up every one of those and knock them all down. There's no universal list of savings clauses. There are lots of examples in my paper. I leaned heavily on Professor Smith's treatise for this paper as well. But, you know, you can find savings clauses anywhere. And there's no model form of what savings clauses are. Of course, there's a Producer's 88 lease form that's been modified and mutilated and extended and addended and changed every which way it can be changed. And so I'll say this a few times throughout the presentation, but far and away, the most important thing to do when you're dealing with savings clauses and trying to figure out what they mean and whether they fit your circumstance is read every word of the lease and read every word of the savings clause. These aren't generic things that are just categorized with a given effect because, as I said, the parties are free to make up any savings clause or any other lease provision they choose. The first category we're going to talk about is commencement of operations clauses. As Yogi said, it gets late early out there. I'm sure you all have similar circumstances as I do. Just within the last couple of weeks, I was preparing a title opinion for a client, and they have three leases that were, you know, they're going to spud May 1st. They have three leases expiring in April. So, you know, you may want to know this. You may want to figure out if you've commenced sufficient operations for this activity. Obviously, a commencement of operations clause extends the lease if the lessee has commenced certain operations. The words used are very important. I'm sure you've all seen and drafted leases with commencement of operation provisions that have very specific things that must be done in order to qualify as commencement of operations or commencement of drilling or commencement of a well. And certainly the reason for that is that the cases that have interpreted commencement of operations clauses have been, I guess in my estimation, absent something more specific in terms of the required activity, they've been relatively generous to the lessee on what activities can qualify as a commencement of operations. You know, is it, well, we had a drilling meeting and we committed to really think about drilling this well and therefore we commenced operations? Or is it, moving dirt to build a pad site, or is it actually having a bit in the ground with a rig that's capable of reaching the target formation? You know, if you don't have a provision that specifically says that one of those things is required, then you're going to be relying on your litigation department to do their best to hold your lease if the lessor pushes it that far. And I provided the Valence operating case that sort of summarizes in that quote that a lot of preparatory activities in the absence of express language otherwise can be considered commencement activities sufficient to perpetuate the lease. Generally, there's a good faith component. In addition to the objective component, there's a subjective good faith component, not only with respect to the activities that are undertaken to perpetuate the lease, but also seeing them through. The lessee is required not only to commence operations timely to qualify under this savings provision, but the lessee is required to also complete the well in a reasonably timely fashion and pursue those activities after it has commenced the operations.